Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks. This episode of Breaking Banks is supported by Banking Circle, the financial infrastructure provider you can bank on.
Today, it's my great pleasure to have on the show the Lord Mayor of the City of London, William Russell. He has secured his second tenancy recently, Lord Mayor William Russell, and Joanne Barefoot is helping me with this today as the co-host. Welcome to Breaking Banks, Lord Mayor.
Well, thank you for having me. And yes, I'm the 692nd Lord Mayor, and I have been re-elected for a second year. And for those historians who are listening, the last time that happened was 1860, 1861. A Lord Mayor called William Cubitt, who was of the Cubitt Building firm, and he built Covent Garden. And I joke that he was re-elected because of his largesse to the city and the banquets. And I'm probably the cheapest Lord Mayor there's ever been.
You know, a qubit's, of course, a form of memory for quantum computers now. So he was really ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Very good.
And what do you attribute your success to?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid it's nothing to do with my success. It's to do with COVID-19 and the fact that, you know, they wanted continuity, which I think is the right decision, and hopefully leadership for a second year. And, you know, that's what's happening. But I've been as busy as ever. And in fact, I would argue that my reach as Lord Mayor of the city has probably got to more people since COVID-19 than if it had been a normal year where I travel 100 days of the year and go to about 30 different countries.
Yes. And so you've got a tour coming up for US and Canada scheduled, I think, is it next month?
No, actually, I've completed the tour. It was a very successful tour for North America, and we spent 4 days, and I took about 14 delegates with me. The first time I've done that on a tour, and we met a massive VCs in North America, and it worked out very well.
You know, obviously with Brexit coming, there's a little bit of uncertainty as to how this sort of plays out over the end of the year. But the UK and particularly the City of London have carved out a very sort of special relationship with fintech in respect to the support for fintech, employment numbers and so forth. How do you think COVID has sort of played into that in respect to the whole fintech positioning for London?
Well, I think it's played into our strengths, actually, and fintech and the digitization, as you know, has really been brought forward. In fact, I was doing a call just today for the ASEAN region, and I was quoting that digitization has brought companies forward by 18 months because of COVID. And so, in a way, it has played into our hands. You've seen a lot of fundraising. I just read a report that came out last week from London and Partners that of the money raised in the first 9 months of this year, 60%, over 60%, came from North American VCs. So I jokingly say we're giving away the family silver to our American friends. It seems a pity that we haven't quite got the ecosystem for that scaling up, but I can assure you we're working on it.
Well, I think traditionally, you know, venture capital has obviously been strong in the US. Private equity tends to be stronger in Europe. So it's a different type of or different class of investment. You know, early stage for the US, a little bit more growth company oriented for Europe. In respect to the UK, you know, where do you see the relationship with the City of London and, you know, based on the fintech and where we're going now, you know, with the US election, you know, just still up for grabs as we go to recording here, and what's happening in China? How do you see sort of the geopolitics of that from a fintech perspective?
So from a fintech, I'm not sure that I'm convinced the politics, whoever becomes president of America, won't change the growth in the sector. and the interest from the VCs in North America. And I think we know what's going on in Shenzhen, and President Xi has openly said Shenzhen is the tech center or the fintech center for China. I've been there, I'm sure you've been there. It's remarkable what's happened to Shenzhen. I used to live in Hong Kong, and when I was there in the mid-90s, it was sort of 10 years before Shenzhen was literally a fishing village or a fishing town. So I don't think that's going to change it. I think, you know, the politics are different in lots of ways. America being as the free market it is, and obviously we've had some issues with the Ant Group IPO, and we'll see what comes of that. And I'm sure there are lots of things we don't know or why they decided to pull that deal, or the authorities did. But, you know, in a way, I've always said in the nicest possible way, when you compare Alibaba to Amazon and look at the different multiples that they trade on, I think what's happened to Ant Group tells you why Alibaba has always been substantially cheaper than Amazon. There's political risk is greater in that part of the world than the political risk in America.
There's obviously this sort of seismic event with Ant, because, you know, if Ant maintains its current sort of pre-IPO valuation, then when they do list, they become the third largest financial institution in the world, beating out ICBC. So the politics of that internally in China must be horrendous. But for China, I think it's a good thing. It does definitely, as you say, position Hangzhou and Shenzhen as unique centers of excellence when it comes to the growth of fintech. In the UK, you know, what are you guys doing at the moment in respect to encouraging more investment in fintech, but particularly encouraging employment in fintech? Because, you know, the dynamic's different now in COVID. We've got this working from home, you've got Brexit. So what's your strategy as the Lord Mayor of London when it comes to encouraging that continued employment growth?
So my role, as you know, as the Lord Mayor of London, is I'm the ambassador for financial and professional services for the whole of the UK. So that includes fintech around the UK. And I say, you know, the UK is the fintech center of the world, and that's not just London. So, for example, I was a very good fintech company when I was doing a virtual trip to Glasgow. And not many people know this, but Glasgow is the third largest financial centre in the UK, after Edinburgh is the second one. And there are 146 fintech companies in Scotland. And in Glasgow, there's this company called Encompass. They have 55 employees up there. They have 35 employees in London. So London is without a doubt the hub. And I think the country recognises that. But because the ecosystem is so close, and we, you know, Glasgow is not 5,000 miles away like New York to California or Silicon Valley, it's 400 miles, and you can get there in 6 hours on a train. So it's a very much a tighter ecosystem, and I think that works to our advantage. Now, the cities are struggling, London's struggling, and people are working from home, but I don't think the office is dead. I've always said that. Because I just, the number of conversations you can have, an idea generation, as they say in American parlance, around the water cooler or over here around the coffee machine, is incredible. And as much as I like communicating over Zoom, it's not quite the same when, you know, you and I, Brett or Joanne, could have a little quiet conversation on our way out or whatever, saying, you know, what do you think? And I just think that's not going to change. So, but the working from home has been hugely successful, and that's part of the problem here with financial services and the fintech sector. Because, I mean, you just look at the financial services results that have come out, whether it's Morgan Stanley or Barclays, and they've all done incredibly well. So, you know, from that perspective, you could argue that the technologies worked very well during COVID-19.
Absolutely. Joanne?
Yeah, I have a question. So, Lord Mayor, at the risk of giving away yet more of the family's silver, what are the reasons that London in particular has become the fintech capital of the world, beyond the point you made about proximity? So that people can get together. What's the secret to that?
So the main reason is regulation. And that's where we start off. And the FCA and the regulator, after the financial crisis, when, you know, we have five incumbent banks, And after the financial crisis, I think everyone saw an opportunity to take on the incumbent banks. And I remember when fintech started, you know, the big banks were like, how do we cope with this? I mean, is this disruptive technology or is this a threat? And actually, originally, I think they thought it was a threat. And then they said, no, actually, we've got to collaborate with this because this is the future. And I talk about how Lloyds Bank owned 10% of Thought Machine, which is one of a great fintech company.
Yeah, great.
And you know, they're doing business with Standard Chartered and I think SEB, and they've got other banks, even though Lloyds own 10% of them. And you've seen other banks that own a percentage of fintech companies. But regulation is the key. And what we have here is the FCA, who not only regulate, but they also have the remit of looking at competition. And the consumer, and that's really what helped us. And also, they were innovative at the FCA. They did Project Innovate. They created a regulatory sandbox, and now they're creating a digital sandbox, which we're working very closely with them on. So it's an interesting time. But that would be the one thing that has made us better. No, I mean, that's the main thing. The other thing is London's a wonderful place to live. We attract a huge amount of talent. I'm a big culture vulture. I love the arts. You know, you've been here. London has it all. And I love New York, my second favorite city. But, you know, London has this wonderful heritage and tradition. As you know, I'm the 692nd Lord Mayor. It dates back to 1189. And, you know, that is something that, you know, stays with us and works to our advantage.
I think the UK, obviously, from a regulatory perspective, really did lead the world in many respects. You know, the fintech charter, you know, for players like Starling and Monzo, Oak North. You know, this was materially a big change. You know, the US is still grappling with this, but of course, Hong Kong, Singapore, and others have followed the UK's lead. Where do you go from here in terms of encouraging this mishmash or this amalgamation? Is a better word, actually, amalgam of the best fintechs and the best that the high street has to offer?
So, it's an interesting question. Where do we go? I think that, you know, when we did the Innovate Finance Global Summit a number of years ago, you know, I think there were 85 peer-to-peer lenders. Now, we all know there aren't 85 peer-to-peer lenders now. One of the things we have in this country, which is another thing I would say, Joanne, which has helped us, is the tax system under Enterprise Investment Scheme. You know, we're very good at the startups. Now, the problem is that because there's this tax break, and I always quote, I think it was in 2018, there was £1.97 billion put into EIS companies, obviously not all fintech, that they aren't all going to survive. And so what's happening now is COVID. It's a bit of a cliche, but it's true. It's about the survival of the fittest. And it's not just in fintech. It's in every business because businesses have had to adapt and innovate. So I think you're going to see some of that happening. I mean, look what happened to my friends at RateSetter, one of the big peer-to-peer lenders. You know, they didn't cope with the demand and the situation. Zopa's fine at the moment because, you know, they got a bank license, but now Metro Bank have bought RateSetter. So you can see how it's that's how it's coming about, I think. But what has also happened is, you know, there's still more startups and the world has changed a bit. And on my trip, which was fascinating, every single one of the VCs I spoke to had made their first investments virtually. They never even met companies. So that's changing a lot. But there's still this growth going on, which in the sector, which is very, very exciting. But it's also part of the digitization that we're seeing because of COVID-19, which has accelerated that.
Very good. Joanne, did you have a question?
Yeah, one of the cutting edge technologies that we're looking at here is AI and profound questions of how it should be regulated to be sure that it's fair and does more good than harm. Do you have thoughts on that future and do you have exciting developments in the UK on innovation with AI?
So we definitely have exciting developments. It's on the regulatory front. I think they're looking at it all the time and adapting accordingly. I'm not an expert enough on the AI, but You mentioned Oak North. I mean, look at Oak North and their success story, and they would argue a lot of it's AI related. And I think that's that what they're doing is very, is hugely positive. So AI, I think if managed correctly and regulated correctly, is hugely positive. But I don't know where it's going to ultimately take us. But I think on the virtual trip, there seemed to be a huge amount of interest in AI. But I sense people are still grappling with the outcomes from it.
Yeah. What are the hottest innovations that you're seeing? What are the hottest fintech?
You've done a lot of promotion aggressively of the fintech. So who do you?
Yeah. Rate? So what are the hottest? I mean, a lot of it's around RegTech, to be frank. And that is because as people set up online, you know, the RegTech bit is behind the scenes is very important. Whether it's knowing your customer and all that sort of thing, that and making that efficient so it's quick and efficient. And you've seen how Revolut have adapted and changed just recently or in the last 6 months because they were given a hard time on the RegTech and the customers and money laundering. Not to say they were doing any of that, because they weren't. But it seems to me that that's something that everyone is has been focused on, and the FCA has been focused on that. So that's a lot of the hot space is getting the regulations and the technology correct. I took on a trip a company called Radar, RRADAR, about 2-3 years ago, Chicago. And I was on Sir Charles Bowman's mayoral trip, and they're all about that RegTech. That, funny enough, they're based in Leeds, but they're in London, and they met a whole lot of insurance companies, and I think some of their clients are the big insurance companies in Chicago. And you know, that is definitely having an area that is continuing, I think, to grow in a positive way. Coming back to your point, Brett, about what's going on in America. I read an article, and you may know the name of the company, but is it Varo?
Varo. Yeah, Varo yeah. Money.
So,
yeah.
You know, and they're now taking deposits. And so America recognizes that they need to adapt. And you've got, obviously, Revolut and Monzo coming in. And so it's all happening, I think, for America as far as, you know, where we've been with a lot of fintech companies. It's bound to, and because that's what the consumer wants.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about the US-UK relationships from a trade perspective a little bit. Yeah. You've been obviously involved in that, you know, your tour to the US and Canada promoting some of that. But how's that going to play into the whole fintech space as, you know, we get stronger UK-US ties?
So, we have a very good relationship on financial services with the US, and the trade bit. Well, I mean, we're talking trade with America across the board, if there is a change of presidency, we will continue to talk. It may delay things, but when it comes to financial services, we're pretty transparent. I mean, look how many American banks there are in the city. You know, what we want is sort of the transparency. I think it's all going to be around data. I mean, you know the phrase data is the new oil, and data is critical. So I think that is something that is going to come out of it. But I'm pretty sure that when it comes to financial services, retrade with America, we're on the same page. Look, it's going to be more about some of the other aspects of trade. Whether it's whiskey or whether it's chlorinated chicken or whatever, I don't think it's going to be. I don't think financial services will be a problem.
I think the chlorinated chicken thing was a whole. We could go off on a tangent on that in respect to standards. You know, there's obviously been some attention on the challenger banks globally during COVID and questions around their viability and so forth. You know, you're pretty close to this. How do you think the likes of Monzo and Starling and Oak North, as we say, how are they faring during COVID from a London perspective?
Well, I think they're doing fine, partly because they've been in a very good position to help with the loans, the C-bills, and the the business loans that the Chancellor has given out, and they've been part of that process. I had another one of our fintech companies, Iowaka. You may have heard of Iowaka, yep. Chris. And they're, funny enough, looking to open an office up in Leeds. But they have an office in London. And that's what I like about this ecosystem we've created in the UK, is that it's not just about London, as I've said. But so they've all benefited in a way because of that, and they've adapted accordingly, and they've been helping with the loans. You know, then when that ends, there's going to be the next moment of how you expand in various parts. I mean, Monzo, you may have read have now come out with an account that they're going to charge for, because, you know, at some point, yeah, you've got to look at the bottom line. Otherwise, the investors aren't going to give you any more money to grow to the next stage. So they're definitely at the stage where they're all, where's our growth path next?
Maturing.
Which is what we wanted, or what we want ultimately.
I have a question. The FCA definitely has led the world in regulatory innovation and fostering innovation, and introduced the original regulatory sandbox some years back, and also the regulatory tech sprint, which is really important. But this year they've put together the digital sandbox, and it's really a different concept. Can you talk about what that is and what you think the impact's going to be?
So I don't know. I'm not knowledgeable enough to tell you in depth about the digital sandbox, but I do think, you know, there's something going on. My son just said today, "Have you seen Bitcoin today, Dad?"
Yeah.
And you know, I was talking to some people in the summer who said that, you know this more than me because you're more an expert, but there's a limited amount of Bitcoin that can be mined. And if everyone recommended 1% of their assets, rather like gold, in Bitcoin, it wouldn't be at £11,000 it is today. And I think a lot of people are looking at that. And so this whole digital area has, I think, been brought forward by COVID. Because to be frank, when was the last time you used cash? Okay, it's cashless payments, and then you got digital. And I think it's focused a lot of people's minds on that whole, on the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And then the PayPal news came out a couple of weeks ago. You saw another uptick. So look, I mean, someone said to me, Bitcoin's either going to $1 million a Bitcoin or going to zero. But when it's £11,000 or $12,000, most people think the upside's pretty attractive, and they know the downside could be zero. I suspect there's something going on. I have a number of friends of mine who are in the hedge fund business. And I know they've been buying Bitcoin, a lot of the hedge funds. Mm. I think that the digital area is just going to get bigger. I don't know whether that answers your question, Joanne, because I'm not an expert in exactly what the sandbox, but it's sort of is centered around that a bit.
It's funny, actually. If you look at the volatility of Bitcoin and gold over the last 10 years, Bitcoin's less volatile than gold. So that's really interesting. But okay, final question for you today, sure. Respectful of your time, Lord Mayor. But let me ask you something a little bit more personal. What do you hope your legacy is going to be when you look back on your period as Lord Mayor and what you've accomplished? How would you like people to remember, you know, your successes and what you've done?
So I think if you said to me, what is the one, I've got another year, what is the main thing on your agenda? It's all around climate change and sustainability and the green agenda. We've got COP26 coming here in November 21. We're hosting the Green Horizon Summit literally on Monday. We've got an array of speakers. We've got over 2,000 people. We will send you the registration, because if you have time, Brett and Joanne.
We'll promote it, yeah.
Yeah, promote it to your team. It's going to be fascinating. That is what I'd like my legacy to be, because I think there is a huge opportunity to make a difference in the world. And as I've said to you, I proudly say, you know, I see the UK as the fintech center of the world. And to be frank, I see the UK as the green finance, the sustainable center of the world, because we're way ahead of a lot of countries what we're doing. And we just came out with a climate strategy action plan for the City of London, where we're going to be zero emissions just here in the square mile by 2040. And that's scope 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, that's pretty ambitious. So that, I think, if you but you've asked me that question. It's all around the green agenda and what we can do, because ultimately you cannot achieve what we want to achieve with net zero emissions without finance. And that's what we want to do, is set the mark and help finance the zero emissions targets.
Fantastic. Well, I applaud you for that, and I congratulate you on your continued success. Joanne and I and the team at Provoke and Breaking Banks, we're very grateful that you've given us your time today, and we wish you and London in the post-COVID, post-Brexit world all of the success, particularly when it comes to the ongoing development of fintech.
Well, come visit in the new year.
We would love to. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Banking Circle's proprietary technology enables payments businesses and banks of any scale to seize opportunities, compete, and grow. From multi-currency accounts to fast access to lending services, international payments and local clearing to real-time FX, Banking Circle solutions are quick, low-cost, and secure. Bypass legacy systems and enable global banking services for your clients. Banking Circle, the financial infrastructure provider you can bank on. Find out more at bankingcircle.com. 2020 has been the year of uncertainty. And if nothing else, it's taught us the value of being lean and staying flexible. And Fiverr can help you find the right freelance talent to do just that. Fiverr is an online marketplace that connects businesses with all kinds of freelancers. Fiverr makes it easy to run and scale your business by helping you find the right resources, and you only pay for what you need when you need it. I like Fiverr's search engine. It's built right into their main page. You can search for all kinds of experts, and you have plenty to choose from at really affordable rates. It's easy to find what you need. You can search by service, deadline, price, seller reviews, and more. I've hired some great freelancers recently for logos and art design, audio engineering, and for a complex data visualization project. You'll know exactly what you're paying for up front. No guessing games and no negotiating needed. Whether you're launching a new business, scaling up a growing one, or you just need some extra support to complete a project, Fiverr's global network is here to help, and they have 24/7 customer service. Check out Fiverr.com with two R's and receive 10% off your first order by using the code BREAKING. Find all the digital services you need in one place at Fiverr.com and use code BREAKING. One more time, that's Fiverr.com with two R's and use code BREAKING to save 10%.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
The Finovate podcast is your home for interesting conversations and insights from Finovate's global conference series. I'm Greg Palmer. Join me as I interview leading innovators, bankers, analysts, venture capitalists, and more to get their thoughts and predictions on the future of financial technology. Find us wherever you normally listen to podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Hello and welcome to Women in FinTech, a Breaking Banks initiative bringing females into focus. I'm your host, Chloe James. Women in FinTech seeks to tackle some of the big issues and dig deep on those uncomfortable topics. Statistically, financial services and technologies are industries still dominated by men. We know that. Mash them together, FinTech, and there remains some great challenge when it comes to gender inclusion and diversity, particularly when we look at the bottom line. Where the rubber hits the road, I'm talking pay parity and our bank balances. Today, we're going to dive into that exact topic. Released just earlier this month by venture investment platform Anthemis was a report titled Empowering Female Founders, Moving from a Vicious Cycle to a Virtuous Cycle. It explores the inequalities in our industry that are the result of biases native to the system and which persist throughout the entire investment process. Although so many of these disparities are widely known, the report outlines the difference between talk and action, as well as illustrating what true change really looks like, plus so much more. It's a fantastic report. Joining me to chat about it is Katie Palencia and Ellie Polanco. Katie is a venture studio lead at Anthemis. She is based in New York and develops new digital era concepts and ventures with a focus on female-founded businesses. Prior to her current role, she served as an interim executive for an early-stage sport marketing and technology company where she supported retired professional athletes on their investment opportunities, new business build-outs, and corporate brand partnerships. She is also a founder. She founded an early-stage tech company, which was acquired in 2017. Ellie Polanco founded Novello close to a year ago to help protect digital payments from cyber threats. Novello protects customers from cyber threats like synthetic identity, account takeover, and funding abuse with real-time risk detection. Prior to this work, she led various research and development digital payments initiatives at JP Morgan, including crypto payments and other account-to-account payment rails. Great to have you both on the show.
Thank you so much. We're excited to be here.
Yeah, listen, I'm so excited to have you both. I want to dive straight into this report, which I absolutely loved. It's a fabulous, really, really sort of concise report, but delivering a lot of really amazing information. Katie, can I just start with you a little bit behind the ethos of Anthemis, because I really loved your company's guiding principles, and then also when and why the report came about?
Sure. Yeah. So Anthemis, FinTech VC, we are focused in both New York and in the UK. And, you know, really beyond just investing, we are guided on three principles, and that's really diversity, inclusion, authentic collaboration, and virtuous cycle outcomes. And so when we put this report together, and that's really been in our DNA since the company and since the firm was founded 10 years ago, you know, we really kind of approached this report in that same way. And, you know, I lead the Female Innovators Lab within Anthemis, and that's just one portion of what we do here in Anthemis Group as it relates to investing and supporting companies. But, you know, if you look at the data in 2017, we did have, some movement in investing in female founders. And what we're seeing in even the last quarter here in 2020 is that unfortunately we were making some incremental progress, but then we see a slight dip, and we hope that's not a trend. And as we approach this, we realize that it's so much more than just driving capital to founders. And if we're really going to transform more female-founded business, more capital, we have to look at it at various components within the ecosystem. And, you know, that can't just be capital. It has to be, more diverse investors driving capital, more diverse LPs, more corporate partnerships with women at the helm, leadership positions, board members. And we believe that all of these things are connected. Just as unfortunately there's been a vicious cycle, we think all of these connected can create a virtuous cycle to really move the needle to get these numbers where they need to be. So that's really how the paper was born. We believe you can't approach this just from looking at one area of the problem. And that's why Female Innovators Lab was started, and that's also where this white paper came to be.
Yeah, I love it. I love that you're talking there about the sort of seniority of positions and how it starts from there, because I was having a think about this before coming to air today, and I was sort of thinking about the CFO for the company that I work for, RFI Group, is actually a woman. And I was sort of just having this interesting thought with myself about the sort of like the trust that I have in that she has my best interests at heart. I'm being really open here. That was just a thought I had. Any view on that? Because that kind of touches to your point a little bit of if there are the senior women in those kind of positions, they certainly will, well, I would hope, look at a female founder or a female businesswoman in an equal light.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that we have something similar here in our organization, Anthemis. So we're co-founded female founder, Amy Noyakis, and coming from that financial services background as well, bringing those leadership qualities into this organization, I think has been instrumental in then leading us to being 57% female out of 45 employees. So I think there's something definitely to be said to that. And then, as you look at Ellie's fantastic background, of, you know, her leadership, capabilities and presence there at JP Morgan, and then taking those experiences to start her own company. That really kind of has network effects in how she builds her team as well. And I often like to say, you know, it's a little bit cheesy, but you can't be what you don't see. And so, just as you mentioned, you know, your CFO and being around that presence and realizing the capabilities and the opportunities there, I think we're going to see a lot of network effects around that. And working with Ellie, just super excited of those experiences that she brings to then continue that work to build her own teams and how that is integrated into how she even thinks about her products and services in the market.
Yeah, that's a fantastic segue to Ellie. And I do want to bring it over here to Novello's design approach and your background with JP Morgan blockchain and how that has kind of, that journey has been for you, Ellie, and how you're using, I guess, the skills and expertise that you build at JP Morgan to then create your own company.
Absolutely. I think I had a lot of learnings at JP Morgan, not just as it relates to how to think about payments in a meaningful way, but also, as you rightly pointed out, just being able to rise up the ranks there as a woman and having women mentors while I was there was incredibly important. Important and really provided a platform for me to grow. And it's definitely something that I'm bringing over to Novello, not just ensuring that we give opportunities to early employees to grow, just as I did when I was at JP Morgan, but ensuring that there is representation across the board in the way that I'm growing the business. Because I really do think better representation in product, it is building a product leads to a better product. Mm. So there's definitely a linkage to what I've learned based on my own experience and what I'm trying to bring as I build a new company.
One of the points I did want to touch on was that, you know, you are a tried and tested product creator, and the report, the Anthemis report, really talks as well about, you know, female created products and how that with the representation can in the product build can in fact lead to a better product. Katie, can you just touch a little bit where the report goes to on that point?
Sure. So I think when people hear this, they think that, oh, you have to go build these products for women. And that's really not, you know, of course, there are certain needs for certain populations. And as you look at who your target audience is, you want to be so mindful of these things. But to Ellie's point as well, this like diversity of thought, right, as well. And I think, you know, we look at diversity at kind of so many face value levels, but it is so connected of diversity of networks, right? Diversity of background and how this all fits into the picture in developing your product. I mean, you know, we have a portfolio company, Rally Road, that allows you to buy antique and shares in antique and collectible products in the secondary market, right? Things like vintage cars and sports memorabilia. And what they realized recently is that, oh, hey, what about, collectible vintage handbags as well? So that's one very like literal example. Mm. But I think also, you know, different perspectives in how the product is just even internally being developed. Those experiences from previous, roles, previous kind of responsibilities, how they're bringing that thinking into developing the product and then communicating it to customers who are also going to come from so many different diverse backgrounds is so key. And I think it's really kind of overlooked. And it's, again, you know, as we look at this virtuous cycle, driving more capital to female founders, that's another component of it as well.
Yeah. Talking about driving capital, I was looking at the report, and I really do encourage everyone to read it, but there were some quite disturbing quotes that came out of, you can't make this up. And the statistics around gender discrimination, and you've got a couple of points in there, and not to sort of harp on about the fact, but there's some pretty concerning, I guess, you know, scenarios that are outlined in the report here. Ellie, have you faced these kinds of, I know that you know the bit that I'm talking about, have you faced these kind of issues in finding investment?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I've often talked to Katie about how I approach it, which is playing offense as much as possible. I do think that, which is all I can control, right? Like I focus on what I can control on my side of the house, mm-hmm. And try not to let sort of negative biases and pattern matching that may go against who I am and what I'm bringing to the table, like affect me. So for me, as it relates to fundraising, you know, that meant, you know, really, really talking to as many people as possible and really trying to create a bucket of the people that, you know, these people are not interested in going past their bias, and these people are actually interested, and just focusing on those, but really playing on the numbers game. And to be honest, I do think the bar is a little higher whenever you're trying to go against, again, the pattern of what's usually funded. And so that means doing that extra effort, extra work, and you know how you're presenting your pitches, putting together personal references before it's even asked, client references, showcasing as much documentation around what you've done or what you can build as you can. Where others might come in and just talk about an idea, and you know, just with that and who they are, they can get funded. I think for folks that are coming from underrepresented backgrounds, I think the name of the game is that until the industry sort of fixes itself, that's mm-hmm. how I've tackled the problem. It exists. Yeah. It's out there. Try to focus on pointing my attention to the folks that align to my interest and presenting as much as I can the work that I've done to get here.
Awesome advice there for any founders listening to the show. That's just an absolute gold nugget there, Ellie. I want to talk a little bit about pay parity, and I said we would touch on this. There was a note in the report. I'm going to read it out. In the US, it is estimated that the average woman will finally reach pay parity in 2059. Oh, I have to take a breath on that. For women of color, the rate of change is even slower. Black women will wait until 2130, and Hispanic women will wait until about 2224. Now, doing the math on that, as this is me, right, a white woman, I would say, of privilege, that's about 20 years after I am probably set to retire, which I found incredibly depressing. But I wanted to touch on this pay parity piece, particularly Katie, and, you know, where we stand now. Well, I've just outlined it, certainly from your research, but what's it going to take to really kind of, you know, reach a change? And do you think that forecast can be any more hopeful than what I've just outlined?
Sure. So I find it, you know, ironic that we often hear, well, it's a pipeline problem in investing in female founders. And so, okay, let's assume that, which I disagree with wholeheartedly and have so much data over the past year to back that up. Mm-hmm. But then it's saying, okay, well, let's take a step back and not accept that. Why is there a pipeline problem? And for me, it's just so obvious. If we have such a pay gap, right, how are we going to drive women to start companies, right? How can we build wealth? We're already on the back footing, right, if the data is accurate. And then you want us to, you know, get out there and start these companies where we have been, you know, historically underpaid compared to our male peers. And so that's first and foremost of like, we also need to look at that if we are going to have more female founded businesses and drive more capital to that. And so that kind of goes back to, again, of like another piece of, yes, we're talking about driving capital female founders. What are we doing about the pay gap? But what we can do is when, you know, there's so many fantastic funds out there driving capital and really calling attention to the need for underrepresented founders. But what's going to happen, I really firmly believe, is that the network effects of that is that underrepresented founders, female founders, and And Ellie has been great in kind of being very cognizant, intentional about this of, well, what does that mean for gender pay gap in my company, right? And so when these conversations are having early on and there's more dollars flowing to female founders, let's ride the tails of these network effects and start to make change in that way on the pay gap.
Yes. Ellie, what would you add to that?
Yeah, no, I think I love Katie's point, which is it's a never ending cycle. If from the get go the foundation is set to incentivize some versus others, that house is going to grow tilted. And so we really want to focus on the foundation, which things like, you know, proper pay across the board is the way to go.
Yeah. And transparency around it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And one thing to add to that is that, you know, in building, you know, wealth and not only in salary, but in equity as well. You know, so Carta did a study, table stakes, around how much equity females receive in companies compared to their male peers. And not shockingly, but unfortunately, those numbers were skewed as well. And so if we have more female investors coming into the ecosystem, and maybe they came in as female founders, you know, within startups, exiting businesses, having lucrative careers, we know that they're more likely to invest in founders, be LPs in funds, which have maybe targeted theses around underrepresented founders. And that's the other piece of this, where if we can solve that, again, we create this cycle, this ecosystem. So there's so many positive benefits that can come from just addressing singular problems.
Yeah, and right up to, as we sort of at the top of the conversation, you know, talking about that board level and the VC level, and if there is the equality up there, then it can only feed down. Another point you made in the report, which was something that I've been really interested in lately, was Citigroup appointing Jane Fraser as the first, you know, their CEO, who's coming in February 2021. That's a, you know, massive global company with a now female, well, soon to be female CEO. We've also seen some incredible, you know, women in politics, you know, leading at the moment. We'll see what happens next week in the US. I'm hopeful, but also, you know, in New Zealand, closer to home for me, and other parts of the world, Germany. Do you feel like these kind of really strong leading women in politics, in banking, and other sectors go away to sort of really helping kind of support the cause here?
I agree, and especially in fintech, right? So much, you know, of early stage companies, whether or not your business model is traditionally or intentionally linked with financial institutions, they are a core piece of this and building these businesses. So I think, you know, we have a partnership with Barclays on a corporate venture side, some amazing female executives, their group chief innovation officer is a female and very committed to this, right? So then that's another area that plugs in, is the corporates and the financial institutions that are getting in front of this and saying this is a priority, but also saying, you know, this is where it's headed. This is what we can do. This is how we want to contribute. This is how we can work with early stage companies, rather than, you know, historically, you know, it's been very difficult to work with these corporate financial institutions. And so just signals like that show us things are shifting and that we're all realizing the ecosystem works better for everyone, for VCs, for corporate, for LPs, for the startups, for the investors, when we make an intentional effort to not only work together, but recognize how diversity really does lead to more innovation.
Yeah, intentional diversity. I love that phrase. It's probably going to be the title of the episode. We've only got a couple of minutes to go. These things go so quickly. I'm absolutely loving this conversation. You've just made me think of another great woman I spoke to recently, Jill Doherty, who's the head of fintech at Visa now. Just someone else out there doing some fantastic things in the VC space as well, and institutional investment, pardon me. But Ellie, just one more for you. Why aren't there more women in our industry? And do you see it changing? Have you sort of seen it change through your career, even in the past few years, and what we could do to help kind of spur that along, more women coming into the fintech space?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I've realized in this journey, and if you think of fintech, you think of a lot of early stage, small companies coming from an entrepreneurial spirit, growing into, you know, big unicorns and interesting opportunities. So if you want to see women and, you know, other underrepresented groups in the later stages, you need to create spaces where they can engage at, you know, day zero. And I think I've definitely seen more work of, for example, the work that Katie is doing to enable that. But I am seeing more sort of female representation as it relates to, for example, early founder communities and networking groups that really focus on helping women transition from, you know, say a corporate job or a, you know, non-startup job into a startup job. I think as it relates to fintech, those bridges into the entrepreneurial community are incredibly important. And that happens with mentorship, guidance, templates that they can follow. And I am feeling very optimistic about the work that's getting done right now in those, what I'm calling bridging communities. It's really, you know, whether they're virtual now or not, or, you know, there are some that are very like locally focused, others are virtually focused on sectors, but I do think they are lending quite a hand in helping create that bridge.
Katie, you do obviously so much work in this field, and the report sort of goes to do that. What's your best advice for female founders out there to really help kind of push their companies ahead and drive investment, if you like, and growth?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like an old lady saying, well, back in 2012, you wouldn't have believed what it was like these days compared to now. But it is super exciting, and just kind of taking a beat and recognizing, yes, you know, we always say the statistics are depressing, but I see, and I'm involved in it every day of the change that's happening. Mm-hmm. And it's really for female founders or potential female founders to lean into the resources, the support that is out there. I was blown away when we launched Female Innovators Lab with the inbound support that came in from senior executives in financial institutions, investors, other founders that were, you know, later stage of how can we support, what can we do? And I think it's really like taking the, you know, being cognizant now of, use those resources, lean into them, ask the questions, ask, can you support here? Hey, can you connect me into this person? Do you know a good investor that matches? Like, these things are lining up right now. We're having conversations just like that, by recognizing this today on this podcast of, you know, being very pointed in taking full advantage of what is happening and where the shift is happening and leaning right into that. And so that is really my takeaway for today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's to that point that you've made earlier about being intentional, and that's whether intentional on the side of a founder, sort of intentionally kind of going after those networks. I've sung the praises of networks, and particularly female networks, I'll be honest, over the past number of years in my career, and the help that has given me. And then paying it forward, you know, how else can you help someone, you know, coming up the ranks, you know, behind you, if you like, but, you know, really paying it forward, networking, asking the question. That's something, you know, men are great at and great at doing. A female mentor told me that many years ago now, saying, you know, men will typically really push each other forward and along, and there's none of that sort of, you know, jealousy or anything like that. It really is pushed forward, and I do actually feel like it's really shifting in the female-focused way at the moment for the better. So I think that's a really wonderful point. Listen, we've got to wrap it up, but what's next? Where can we hear more about you? Ellie, where can we hear more about Novello and what you're doing
Yeah, I think absolutely the best way is to follow us on Twitter, which will connect you to a variety of other resources that we keep updated, but at @Nivello_payments, it's our handle on Twitter.
Awesome. Thank you. And Katie, we'll, we got a little song there. Katie, where can we hear more from Anthemis? And I will put the note that in the show notes, we will absolutely have a copy of this report and we'll be pushing it out as well because it's a really great read.
Sure, I appreciate that. And sorry about that. That's like my cue to tap dance out of here, I guess. But a couple of things. I mentioned those resources. We run a top five video series where we push out videos very quickly, top five tips on certain topics that we pull early stage female founders about to see, kind of what resources and tips we can provide. So there's that. Check out our top five video series. We host a variety of office hours where connecting with female, we most recently did LGBTQ office hours, female founder office hours, where we've done 300 matches between investors and founders. And I think that's a great example of, it doesn't need to be this massive mentoring over a long period of time. There's so many opportunities to pop in and out. And that's what we're trying to create, kind of these microcosms that happen in the ecosystem. But we are at anthemis.com. You can read more about Anthemis and the Female Innovators Lab and follow us on Twitter at Anthemis. And I just wanted, I know we're at the top, but I wanted to correct one of my statistics that I mentioned at Anthemis. We are out of 48 employees, 52% women. So wanted to make sure I got that stat correct and appreciate so much this conversation. It always flies by when we're talking about these topics.
It absolutely does. Thank you. Thanks for both of your insight here. Great show, great topic, I think, and a great report. Check it out. So that's it for today. Thank you to my guest. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've got anyone you want to hear from or recommend for the podcast, we'd really love to hear from you. I'm Chloe James. Please join us for the next episode of Breaking Banks, Women in FinTech.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform or share it with a friend or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.